en colloque. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Academy. On retrouve Élodie Courtejoie.
Bonjour. Ouragan, pluie torrentielle, crues, sécheresse, depuis une cinquantaine d'années, la planète connaît des épisodes climatiques extrêmes à répéter. En janvier et avril 2007, par exemple, les températures de surface sur Terre ont été respectivement plus chaudes de 1,89 degré et 1,37 degré par rapport aux moyennes enregistrées depuis 1880. Aucun continent n'a été épargné par les cataclysmes. Alors, quels sont les changements climatiques abrupts dans le monde marin ayant un impact sur notre environnement? Quelles sont les interactions entre la faune et la flore face à la variabilité climatique? Élément de réponse dans cette deuxième partie d'une série de 5 enregistrée lors du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007. Le thème plus central de ce colloque consiste à identifier quelles connaissances acquises ou à acquérir sont nécessaires pour préparer les sociétés humaines aux événements climatiques extrêmes. Chercheurs français et étrangers se sont penchés pendant 3 jours sur ce thème. Dans quelques instants, vous allez pouvoir entendre les interventions en anglais de Joël Guillot du Centre européen de recherche en géosciences de l'environnement. Son intervention portera sur les interactions entre végétation et variabilité climatique. Quant à l'anglais Adrian Lister du Muséum national d'histoire naturelle de Londres, il nous parlera de l'impact du changement climatique sur la distribution et l'extinction des grands mammifères pendant la dernière transition glaciaire ou interglaciaire. Auparavant, c'est Laurent Labéry qui prend la parole. Il développe pour nous les leçons à tirer sur les variabilités millénaires du climat sur le monde marin. Laurent Labéry travaille au laboratoire des sciences du climat et de l'environnement, département du CNRS à Gif-sur-Yvette.
En tant que climatologue et je dirais intéressé spécialement au climat ancien, je vais focaliser toute la première partie de mon exposé sur les changements du climat aux différentes échelles de temps. Je vais quand même essayer sur la deuxième partie de parler un peu de biologie et d'écosystème et d'interaction entre écosystème et les changements du climat, puisque c'est pour ça que je suis ici. Et donc ça va. Et je vais aussi parler un petit peu des implications sur le futur. Alors, OK, if we consider the change, the long-term change of climate on Earth, we heard this morning of the current crisis, you have to really to see that the Earth's climate has changed basically because the continent location has changed, and you know that, but basically at some moment you had strong feedback relationship between the position of the continent and the circulation of the ocean, and by example the location compared to the latitudes. If we go to high latitudes, if you put a continent like Antarctica 40-50 million years ago, you begin to separate Antarctica from South America, you begin to make a circumpolar current, and you will make a permanent ice sheet just with the reflectivity of the light. It will, the white ice will put back energy to the space, and it will cool down the Earth. So the whole Earth will cool down a little, and the energy and climate will redistribute. Ocean circulation will change, you will change characteristic of the ocean. And so you have, I don't have pointer, but on the left here, you have so this change of climate since about 50 million years, as recorded with the Delta 18 of Benthic foraminifera. So it's a record of temperature and ice volume, where you see quantitatively all the major climatic change, and with periods like 40 million years ago, with the establishment of Antarctica, and like 15 million years ago and 4 million years ago, with a different stage of establishment of the North Hemisphere ice sheet, basically with when you close the equatorial circulation between North and South America and between Africa and Europe, you get this drastic climate change, which are, in time scale of geology, they are abrupt. And in time scale of geology, they created a lot of change in the ecosystems. If you go to more recent climate change, we have very detailed records of this change, and the kind of curves I'm showing you here now for the last 5 million years are curves which have been repeated over and over in all the oceans, and we know exactly From 5 million years to zero, we have the different stages of evolution of climate, and you see there's a variability which increases in amplitude drastically. In fact, for the last 1 million years, completely at the left of the diagram, we see the last glacial interglacial cycle appearing with the 100,000 years periodicity, and this change corresponds to, you have to realize, very, let's say, 6 to 8 degrees temperature change for the whole Earth's climate mean temperature, and huge amounts of ice with kilometers of ice above New York and Copenhagen and elsewhere. So we know exactly about the establishment of this phenomenon, and we know basically the laws which regulate that, with the accumulation of the North Ice Sheets and modulated by the what we call the Milankovitch oscillation of the Earth's orbicity around Earth's orbit around the Sun. And these parameters also, are well known. They have been modelized by André Berger and Lascar and others, and we know exactly about their properties and how they redistribute heat over Earth, and models are more and more performing to try to reproduce in the observed relationship. So we have a very good conceptual basis to look at what happened, the effects on local environments and ecosystems from that. And one of the big driving, as I spoke about Antarctica, but in the north, the big ice sheets of the north, which establish normally recurring system each 100,000 years is Laurentide and Fennoscandian ice sheets had a huge effect both on the atmosphere temperature with the reflectivity but also on its characteristics, because when you change climate, and here are the classical records from Antarctica, where the red is the temperature change, the blue is the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Basically, when you change the climate of the Earth, you cool the atmosphere, you have less water vapor, so the atmosphere greenhouse gases are lower, you lose more of the infrared to the space, but also you lose more of the CO2 to the ocean, because the ocean gets cooler and changes circulation, and CO2 accumulates at depth. So all these are positive feedbacks and retroactions which makes the amplitude of climate so large. When the driving force is just few watts per square meter from the insulation. And one further scale of change is these ice sheets which built during this 90% of the history of climate since the last 1 million years. These ice sheets are unstable, and that's something we discovered just 10 years ago, is when you accumulate a large amount of ice sheet in a place which is not just a bath, like Antarctica has mountains basically all around, so the ice can stabilize, but in the north it's not the case, or in western Antarctica it's not the case, and the ice sheet, as soon as you accumulate it, it has tendency to flow to the ocean, and this flow, the more you have it's thick, the more it will flow, so it creates oscillations. And this oscillation explains this very rapid climatic change we observe, for example, in Denmark, where you have a 15 to 20 degrees temperature change in less than 50 years, and that over and over again. You have to realize this climate change, which is when you shift the climate in France, for example, in Paris, from a mean climate, which would be in winter, something like Finland or northern Scandinavia, to a mean winter, which would be more something like Belgium or northern France, in few generations. And for summer temperature, you get the same kind of oscillation. It's evident that all the flora and fauna is affected by this change, and very drastic. And when you get temperature in few generations, human generation, which shift from winters with minus 30 degrees to winter which are minus 5 degrees, it's evident it's not the same kind of protection you need. What you have to realize is this climate change, which are, in fact, interaction between high latitude and low latitude, they affect also a lot the low latitude not only with temperature change, but also with water cycles. And by example, at the last climatic optimum, 5,000-6,000 years ago, you had the wood savanna on the Sahara with a large population. And simultaneously, you had so much water around the methane, you have to realize that at that time, methane sea became anoxic because you had a freshwater lead on top of it for certainly periods over several hundred years where you had no deep convection, so on, and all the deep fauna has been affected. There's climate change to observe at low and high latitudes. They're very well recorded in the continental records from pollens accumulating in the marshes and lakes. And by example, here I present you on the top the change in the pollen percentage over the last 100,000 years in Italy, in Monticelli, Lago di Monticello, and where you see all this variability I've shown you on in Greenland, you see exactly the same kind of variability. But basically, what you see is the forest going north and south, and with very few change in the ecosystems. At some point, you had some trees disappearing, like sequoias at some places, just because they are pushed south and there's only the water after, and they will not reappear at that location. But otherwise, the ecosystem basically didn't suffer for this hundreds and hundreds of drastic, very rapid climatic change, which occurs over hundreds and thousand years. See, life is just used to that. So climate by itself doesn't perturbate a system as long as the ecosystem can move from one place to another. And if now I look more at my field, which is the oceans, we observe basically the same thing. If you consider all these fossils for the last 4 million years, foraminifera, diatoms, coccolis, radiolarians, you find that there are very small. Okay, each of the species has its own characteristics of habitat, and especially for foraminifera, most of them are restrained to a very well-constrained temperature range. For example, the Rubeyre, which we have on the top, it's a warm water foraminifera, which live with algaes and in surface waters. And at the bottom diagram, it's polar foraminifera, the Pachyderma left, which live only in polar water at very cold temperature. But as soon as they will find somewhere temperature water available, they will grow happily. There are now people working with the genetics of these, and the species, for example, which are in Southern Ocean for polar forams are not exactly the same as the one in the North Arctic seas, but the shapes are still very similar. And in fact, that analogy between environmental characteristics and the species has been used over and over by paleoclimatologists to quantify the past climatic change. And here, by example, it's a typical core, sediment core from the North Atlantic, which covers 60,000 years. And I've seen exactly as for the pollens, you have the blue, which is underlined in brown, is the polar faunas over the last 60,000 years. And you see we have a drastic. Sorry. When you have the drastic coolings, it corresponds to the arrival of ice rafted detritus because it corresponds exactly to the collapse of the ice sheets. And you see over and over you have this climate change and the flora, sorry for that case, the faunas just go back to the previous stage a few thousand years after or a few hundred years after. So you have to recall from this story is ecosystems and climate varies with very large amplitude, very rapid scale, over and over. And that's just an example of the kind of reconstruction you can do using this fossil foraminifera. Here, that was the temperature, the last glacial maximum, the change of temperature, you see, depending on the places, it's from 8 to 0 degrees. Okay, if we go now to see, okay, something does happen. You do have some species which disappear and some species which appear. Foraminifera, for the last few hundred years, and in fact in the room I've people much more specialized than me, with Marie-Thérèse and others, so you are allowed to say I'm saying something wrong. But to my knowledge, in the recent past, the only major change is the dispersion of one species of the Globigerina rubra pink, which disappeared from the Indian and Pacific Ocean at the last interglacial, but it's still going on in the Atlantic Ocean. So it didn't appear back in the Pacific Ocean just because the Panama Canal is closed, and foraminifera do not go through the canal. Otherwise, if you consider the coccoliths, which is a group which evolves more rapidly, they are small planktic algae, very surface waters, and they appear and disappear regularly all along this time scale. Here you have all these last appearance and first appearance which are marked, and they are not specific to one climatic event or another. So basically, the surface oceans is a slow rhythm of extension and of apparitions, which has not connected with climate change, apparently. For the deep ocean, that's not the same story. In the deep ocean, is much more homogeneous, and when you change its characteristic, it's the whole deep ocean which changes characteristics. So you do not have refuge for large amount of species, and basically at each of the big crises of climate, we have huge disappearance of foraminifera species. And the last of this crisis was just 1 million years ago. And here they are horrible, especially because I have no pointer, horrible diagrams, just to show that in both diagrams, the left one and the right one, we have this progressive cooling, which is marked by the delta 18 curve at the bottom, or at the top, the other case, where you see the change, and the two pink lines show you the particular event of interest, which is a time when the northern hemisphere ice sheets developed between 1 and 0.6 million years. And during that time, there was a major extension of a lot of groups in Southern Ocean, which is the diagram on the left, or in the North Pacific on the right. I could have shown the North Atlantic the same. So it was a global disappearance of a lot of species. And you see, in fact, on the right diagram, each of the horizontal line is one species, and when it disappears. And you see most of the species disappear between my two pink lines between 1 and 0.6 million years. So, first conclusion, the superficial ecosystems seen from microfossils in the ocean, change of spatial distribution with climate change. This climatic change are huge, and you have to realize, and in rhythm and things like that, they are equivalent to what we foresee in the future, at least for the first few hundred years in front of us. But they are remarkably stable in composition. But the deep ecosystems have been affected at several places because their system change completely, when you have practically no more oxygen to breathe in the deep ocean, you have a lot of species, you just cannot go on, or the opposite, when you shift from an ocean which is very poor in oxygen and very rich in nutrient, we shift to an ocean which is very rapidly renewed because you have cool or cold high latitude, which from a lot of deep water, you have a lot of species which disappear. I want to say one word in a few minutes on another system which is different, which is the coral reef and the neritic organism. Because these have been, we heard this morning that earlier they had problems where they disappeared completely at the end of the Permian and reappeared much later. Now they are abundant in the intertropics, and all of us enjoy the high biodiversity of the coral reefs when we have the occasion to dive on these. But these corals are very fragile. They need symbiont algae for the surface corals. It seems they are adapted to quite recently to this warm water. A lot of the corals, in fact, live in deep water and in absence of light. And these corals now, more and more, they are events where we record what we call bleaching or death of, of corals, and there have been a big event like that during the El Nino event in 1998, which was associated with the warming, exceptional warming of the Central Pacific. And these models show that these corals have a level, if the water goes over 29 degrees, they will have tendency to lose their symbiont algae and disappear. And so the model more or less says that around within, let's say, 50 years, most of the corals from the intertropical areas would disappear. In fact, if it was just temperature, it would not be a problem, because if the temperature of the warm ocean gets too warm, it's just some reef would grow in the northern Philippines or southern Australia, that would be okay, because there is room with the right temperature. Problem with corals is there is another problem, which is something I wanted to say one word about, is the carbon dioxide. Simultaneously with warming, the basic thing is we put carbon dioxide in the ocean. And that carbon dioxide, we are looking at it, and it goes down in the ocean. When you see the diagram, we have the Pacific and the Atlantic, and we see in the Atlantic with the deep circulation, progressively the anthropogenic carbon dioxide is going down, and we can measure, and it goes down in pH. And already we have lost since the last 20 years about 0.1 pH unit in the ocean, and so that's measured with that penetration, and when you have to realize that 0.1 pH, that an increase of 20% of the concentration of the of H plus in the ocean. So these are huge numbers, and the ocean is not equipped to resist to this kind of thing as it is now. On the long term, it's okay, because you increase acidity, it will dissolve more carbonate, alkalinity will re-equilibrate, so in a matter of thousands of years, the equilibrium will go back again, and things will be okay. The problem is what will happen within the next few hundred years, because the pH will, and all the models show that the pH will go down at least 0.5 units in the next 500 years. And whatever, even if we stop the emission as soon as we can, this evolution will occur, and we have to face the fact that the ocean will not be able to produce as much organism with carbonate skeleton. The foraminifera are already suffering. Their shell is lighter and lighter, but shells of oysters and corals and everything, the carbonate production will go down in the next few hundred years. There's just no choice for that. And if you look for the Pacific, now in pre-industrial, all the intertropical area were optimal for growth of carbon skeletons and corals. And basically in 50 years, the whole area will be marginal, and you see that going to higher latitude, you get to, in fact, hostile environment for this. So even if the water warms, they will not grow because of the acidity. So that's my second conclusion. So for the ocean, the temperature change are a problem, but acidification will be the real problem for the next 100 years. And if people plays in putting CO2 in the ocean to get out of the atmosphere, the problem will be even worse. So we have to be careful about everything which will increase the organic pump, everything like iron in the ocean, everything which will increase the input of CO2 to the ocean will increase the problem. And in this discussion, I didn't discuss about the fact that not only carbonate-growing animals, but also, in fact, invertebrates are very sensitive to the acidity of the environment. But there are also other problems I didn't talk about, which are directly connected with anthropization. Maybe Lucien Laubier will talk about, which is things connected with the eutrophization and coastal areas pollution, knowing that most of the large part of the reproduction of the marine organism occur near the coast, because there's much more food, and that's the place where they are the most sensitive to what happens. And the next thing is the long-term evolution of the deep water, which will be dramatic if the Arctic ice goes to the point of full melting, because there the condition of deep water formation will be different, and certainly the deep water system will be affected. Thank you.
Merci, merci Laurent Labéry. So now I ask to Joël Guyot to come here. Joël Guyot is director de recherche at CNRS and working at the CEREG. The CEREG is a centre européen de recherche et d'enseignement en géosciences de l'environnement. It's in the University Paul Cézanne in Aix-en-Provence. And Joël Guyot is involved mainly with the impact of global changing on vegetation.
Okay. The studies based on the modern data only consider primarily the space dimension. Time dimension is assumed to be uniform. And an example here, you have here the evolution of the competition between the prey and the predator. And it is supposed, the time is supposed to be constant, and there is no change in any factor in time. This, it's something like an equilibrium between the prey and the predator. But what the time is able to learn, what the paleo studies are able to tell us, is that the time dimension is also its own texture. And this figure, which has been already shown by Laurent, here it's the delta O18, which show that the climate was relatively constant and warm at the beginning of that time period. It is the Pliocene. And from 3 million years BP, we have the beginning of the glacial period and the alternance between interglacial and glacials. In the same time, you see that we have a diversification of the hominid on the Earth. And that shows that the time is not uniform, and we have also to take into account that dimension in our analysis. And I will show you some examples of what the continental record are able to show us. And the first one are the pollen assemblages for the large time scales. And the second one for the short time scale, annual series, it's the annual tree ring series for the last centuries. And both kinds of records are able to show us some interesting information about the relationship between climate and vegetation. And for pollen first, we use cores taken in the bottom of lakes. And from these sediment records, it's possible to analyze the composition of the vegetation by looking at the different species as indicated by the pollen grains. And if we look for the recent period, we can analyze the variation of the tree rings, like in this trunk here. You see the layers. And these layers have a different size, and these size are related to the climate. That discipline is called androclimatology, and it is important to learn about the climatic change for the period before the instrumental data, but also to learn some effect of the climate on the tree growth and just on the forest productivity. And to analyze that, we use some modeling tools. First, I will show you some conceptual modeling. And then, after that, how it's possible to use statistics to infer the climate from this data. And finally, how it's possible to have access to the processes by using biogeographical and biogeochemical modeling. First, the conceptual model, for example, for a species. If we draw an axis where we have, for example, the first climatic variable, I call here environment one, and here a second climatic axis. In orange, we have here the space, which is really realized in the modern time. This all the sites in the world are located inside that ellipse. And we can have, for example, for a given species, a niche, which is, in fact, the space where the species can live. And the intersection between the climatic space in orange and the niche of the species in green, it is, in fact, the niche which is potential for that species. But because it exists also some other biotic effect, it's possible that, in fact, the niche it's not so large. And in black here, we have the realized niche, because there's a situation here are not possible because other climatic factors can interact and make that impossible to realize. Thus, we can start from that to try to understand what will happen to the species if the climate change. And we can have a different change in the environment. For example, if we consider a climate, the two environmental variables which are not correlated, like in that graph here, you have the environment space which is realized at this moment. We can imagine a shift of that space. It can be, if the variable two is temperature, it can be a warming. And thus we have a shift in that direction. It's a possibility. We can also have a shift in the same direction for the two climatic variables, and we have a shift of the ellipse in that direction. In this case, because the ellipse is relatively narrow, that means that the two variables are correlated. It can be, for example, the temperature of January and the temperature of July. And here, we can have a shift only in the direction of variable one. And here, we can have an increase for variable two and a decrease for variable one. Thus, we can have a different combination of climatic change. And if I consider that example, here we have the modern situation in orange, and here we have the shift of that space, which is an increase of the variable one and no change in variable two. And in green here, we have the space where species is located, potentially. And from that, we can have different situations. For example, population A here will shift in that direction, and it was present in that climatic space, orange, the climatic space at time one. It's still present at climatic space two. In this case, population one will maintain. If we look at that population B here, it is present at time T1, but here you see it is outside the green niche, and thus that population will extend. If we look at that one, it was outside at time one, and it is inside at time two. That new population will colonize the new space. And we can have, it's more important for the problematic of the extremes, that population D here was outside the climate orange, the climate at time one, and this, because it was outside, it was not possible to observe it. But if we have a climatic change, we see that D is in the climatic space T2, and it can occur. Thus, what was an extreme which was impossible at time one becomes possible at time two. Thus, we have to take that into account if you want to analyze the interaction between pollen and climate. First, we start from the hypothesis that the pollen records the species movements, and the pollen assemblage indicates species associations. We expect this to infer climate from them, and for that we use a method, which is relatively simple method, which is close the analog method. It is done by comparison of the fossil assemblage to a large data set of modern assemblages. And by that comparison, we may find modern analogs of the past vegetation to which we attribute the climate of these analogs. And the principle which is the basis of that, it is the uniformitarian hypothesis, which says us that the present is the key of the knowledge for the past. But it's in some case, important environmental changes may make difficult that approach. For example, in the case of the seasonality change are very large, or when there is an interference of external variable as a CO2. I will show you an example of that later. Sorry. Now, from the same conceptual model, we can analyze a particular situation where a changing environment may affect the species association. In T1, we have that climatic space here, and here we have the distribution of species 1 and that species 2. And in that triangle here, in yellow, it is in fact the location in the climatic space where we have in the same place as species 1 and species 2. Now, if the climate change in that direction, we see that the location for species 1 will be here, and for species 2 will be here. Thus, the two species will be dissociated. It will not be possible to find the two species in the same place because of that shift of the climate. Thus, in this case, it will be difficult to find analogs for the two species are separated. But if we look in the past at different periods where we had a relatively warm climate, it is called interglacial. Here it is different interglacial period. That one is the Holocene, it's the last 10,000 years. Here it is another interglacial called Imien. It was at about 130 to 115,000 BP. And that was the previous one, and so on. We have here five interglacial, and we see that we have the same, or approximately the same succession of forests during the five interglacials. Thus, that means that if we have some similarities when we look at different warm periods, here we have the cold phase, and you see the succession, it is during the warming of the climate. And we have the succession of Quercus, followed by Carpinus, followed by conifers, and so on. And we can find that succession at almost all the interglacial. Thus, we have a climatic signal which is behind that. And now, I will focalize on an extremely cold event called the last glacial maximum, LGM. And from Poland side, you see the circle here in Europe. It is the place where we have Poland data. And when you have a yellow circle, that means that we have steppes. And when the circle is in rose, we have more tundra vegetation. And in blue, it's taiga. This we have more occurrence of forest in that kind of ecosystems. And if we infer the temperature from that, we see in that maps when it is very black, that means it's very cold, and when it is gray, it is less cold. To summarize, here we have a decrease of the January temperature by about 30 degrees, and here it's about 15 degrees. And if we compare that with the simulation of climatic models, and it is the different color, it is the lines here, we have 17 models which has simulated the climate. And here we have the south, and here it is the north of Europe, and we have a gradient. It is relatively cooler in the north and relatively warmer in the south. And if we plot the data, the previous data, You see that in fact the data are much colder than the climatic simulations. Thus, from that, we have some different questions which can be raised from that comparison. The model are wrong, or the data are wrong, or maybe the truth is in between. And the first question is it possible that the effect of CO2 atmospheric concentration, this effect on the photosynthesis, in the last glacial maximum, the concentration of CO2 was 200 ppm, and now it is 360-70. Is it possible that difference is an effect on photosynthesis, and it will bias the climatic reconstruction? Because to make this a climatic reconstruction, we use the analogs in the modern situation where the CO2 is high, and we try to infer for periods where the CO2 is low. Thus, it is a question. A second question, is it possible that, in fact, the climatic change, which are inferred from this data, are affected by the climate variability and not only by the climatic mean? Thus, it is, in fact, an effect of the extreme event frequency, which should be most frequent in the past than in the recent, in the modern situation. And to analyze that, we need some process models and to make some sensitivity experiment. And if we are able to reply to this question, we may deduce some implication for prospective studies. And the first experiment is to use a vegetation model called Biome 4. It is an equilibrium model where we have a modelization of the carbon cycle and the water cycle. We will use that model in inverse model. I will not give you some detail about that. But in fact, instead to go from the input of the model to the output, the input is the climate and the output is the vegetation. And this vegetation can be compared with the pollen. What we are doing is to try to see which kind of input is necessary to obtain the vegetation which is in agreement with the pollen. And if we do that, it's possible to have a climatic reconstruction and to compare them again with the climatic simulation using GCM. And in this experiment, we compare again some sites, pollen sites, with the climate simulation, and we see that in fact what we obtain it's a less cold climate. We have in fact a climate which is for January, it's 10 degrees warmer than we had with the previous methods. Thus, we see that CO2, which is the main controlling factor, which is different from the previous approach, which is based on statistics, and this approach, which is based on mechanism, the main difference is CO2, and that CO2 is responsible of biasing of the results, and we are able to reconstruct a climate which is 10 degrees warmer than with a statistical method. Now, if we do the same approach for Africa by using a lot of pollen sites for modern and for last glacial maximum, we can analyze the effect of the climate and the CO2 on the tropical mountains, on the tree lines in the tropical mountains. And here, the green line here, it is the position of the tree line for the modern situation. It is at about 3,500 meters in the tropical mountains. And the last glacial maximum, that tree line was 1,500 meters lower. It was at about 2,000 meters. Now, if we do some sensitivity experiment by using the same kind of model, if we change the temperature from that situation, the last glacial maximum, we see that, in fact, it's not possible to move the tree lines to the modern situation by changing the temperature alone. But if we change the precipitation, it's possible to move the tree line to the modern situation. And if we change the CO2, it is the same also. It's possible to move it. Thus, For the last glacial maximum, the key variables was not the temperature, it is in Africa, not in Europe, it was the precipitation and CO2. Now, if we do the same for the Holocene, it is a warm period, it's possible to change the temperature, the precipitation and the CO2 and to see what is the change in the tree line. And if we change the temperature, we see that we can increase the tree line. If we change the precipitation and the CO2, we have no change in the tree line. Thus, for a warm period, the key variable is not anymore the precipitation and the CO2, it is the temperature. Because, in fact, CO2 is high and precipitation are high also. It is not the limiting variables. It is important because when we use the modern situation to analyze the past, it's not possible in this case to transpose directly what we know in the modern situation to the past because the situation is different. And instead to have a CO2 effect and precipitation effect, we have an effect of temperature, in fact. Thus, we need to use a model of vegetation. And I will go quickly on that. I will use now a dynamic model. The previous one was an equilibrium model. And here, we have a competition of individuals. And it is important to analyze the effect of the variability of the climate instead to see only the change in the mean. And this experiment has been done by a colleague of me in my laboratory, by Christelle Ely, and she has used the climatic simulation of the model of IPSL model in Paris, and it is the simulation of the climate for the last glacial maximum. And what the lesson of that, we know that the model is too warm according to the data. And the question is it possible to change not the temperature and precipitation anomalies, but the temperature and precipitation variability, to see if it is possible to have a better agreement with the data. We are again in Europe. Here we have a site in the Vosges, another site in the south of Spain. And when we have here the yellow bar, that means that we have a grassland. And when we have blue or magenta color, it is forest. Thus, if we use the modern climate, like here, we see that we have forest. It's impossible to have the tundra or the steppes we have seen in the data. And if we change the temperature and the precipitation by different factors, the conclusion is that to have a good agreement with the data, we need to cool the climate simulation of the IPSL model by at least 5 degrees. This, the IPSL model is too warm, but 5 degrees. And we have also to decrease the precipitation. The precipitation are also too high in that model. It is the main condition to have a good agreement between data and model. It's to have a warm, cooler climate and a drier climate. And if we increase the variability by a factor of 1.25 or by a factor 3 here, we cannot have a good adequation between data and model. Now, I will shift quickly on the more recent period and by using the tree rings. And if we look some long tree ring series in Sweden and Russia, we can see that we have period with high productivity in the forest and period with low productivity. And here it is the modern period here. It is a relatively high productivity. And we have here the little ice age with the tree rings are low. Here it is the middle age. We have the same, observation in the two regions in Sweden and Russia. We have a warm, we can infer, in fact, a warm summer temperature. And here we have 2,000 years ago, the Roman period, we have again a warm period in Sweden, but it's different in Russia. And if we try to use the long series here in the Mediterranean region, we try to reconstruct the climatic parameters related to the drought by using triune series which are distributed in, around the Mediterranean region here. And if we look at the last 500 years, we see that we have different variability of that index. It is a PDSI, it's the Palmer Drought Severity Index. It's related when it is high, that means that the climate is humid, and when it is low, the climate is dry. And in that period here, we see that we have a large frequency of drought events. And during the Little Ice Age, we have a very high frequency of humid events. And here, in the last period of the 20th century, we have again a drought period. This is a mean for the Mediterranean region. And if we look at the space, we see that, in fact, it's not homogeneous. In some period, we have dry events in the north and humid events in the south. It's much more important. It's much drier in the north. In some other period, we have a difference between east and west. And in some period, we have humid events everywhere. Thus, we have a large variability in time and in space. And by using this kind of data, it's possible also to try to understand what kind of climate is responsible of the tree growth, and also what will happen in the future. I use for that a model called MAIDEN. Okay, it's almost finished. The MAIDEN model here is calibrated on a species called Pinus alepensis, and we have calibrated that model to reproduce the tree growth by using the climatic data. We have a relatively good agreement. The model is able to reproduce the period with the productivity is low, and the period here, like here, where the productivity is high. And if we use a scenario for the next century given by the Météo France model called Arpège, we can extrapolate in the future the tree growth. And in this case, the data are used to calibrate for the last 30 years. And when the calibration is good, it's possible to extrapolate. And we see here that if we use the scenario of the scenario called B2, it's an IPCC scenario, we see that in fact we are at a maximum of the productivity of the Pinus species here, and after that we have a decrease of the productivity for the next century. But in that situation, we don't use a factor which is important, which is the fertilization effect of the CO2. And if we introduce that fertilization effect in the MAIDEN model, we see that, in fact, the productivity will continue to increase until the next 20 years. And after that, it will be approximately constant. Thus, in this case, the CO2 increase is able to mitigate the effect of a drier climate for the next century. Thus, it is an example of where it's possible to use the data in the past to extrapolate in the future by using a model. Thus, in conclusion, the paleoecological data I have presented to you is able to replace the climatic change in the historical context and to find some case studies of larger change which are similar to those anticipated. Thus, it can be, for example, the middle of the Holocene, where we have a warm period, and the last glacial maximum, it is in the opposite direction, but it is a period where we have a large change. The vegetation and the climate variability provide a frame to improve and to test our models. It can be climate models, but also a vegetation model. And they give access to extreme situation, as I told you, the last glacial maximum and the mid-Holocene in the case I have presented. And the integrated approach, data, vegetation model, and climate models it's able to better understand, to facilitate the understanding of the climatic effect on vegetation. And finally, it is able to separate the effect of the mean and the variability by defining some sensitivity exercise by using these process models. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you. So now, last but not least, we'll hear Adrian Lister. Adrian Lister is paleobiologist. He was working at the University College in London. I learned that he's now at the British Museum of Natural History, the Natural History Museum in London, and is a specialist of quaternary mammals. He's interested by the pattern and causes of extinction of large mammals during the quaternary. And I know, probably you know, that he's probably the best specialist of the story of mammoths and elephants.
So I'm going to be talking about large mammals and the effects of the climate and vegetation changes at the end of the last glaciation. And the last two or three talks, which have introduced the climatic and vegetational variability of the late Quaternary, give me a perfect introduction. This is a very simple schematic from a mammalogist's point of view of the so-called steppe tundra biome of much of the last glaciation. This diagram drawn at the time of the last glacial maximum when the ice sheets were at their maximum. And that vegetation, although very complex, was a mostly treeless but rich vegetation of grass and herbaceous vegetation, which supported large numbers of herbivorous mammals and the carnivores that preyed upon them. And the episodes that I'm going to be focusing on are the rapid climatic changes which marked the end of the last glacial period and the beginning of the present interglacial, the Holocene. So from the last glacial maximum, the LGM, to the cold period of the last glacial maximum, the very rapid warming at the beginning of the Burling-Alarod interstadial, the recooling of the Younger Dryas, and then again a very rapid change at the beginning of the Holocene. And put at its simplest, those climatic changes caused the disintegration of the steppe tundra biome and its replacement in the north by the modern tundra and in the south by the boreal coniferous forest, neither of which provided a suitable habitat for the large herds of essentially grazing or grass-eating mammals, such as the woolly mammoth, the most famous member of that fauna. And these changes coincide very broadly with the extinction of a large number of large mammals at the end of the Pleistocene. I'm going to be focusing mainly on the northern biome, that is the northern Eurasian biome, and in particular on two species that we have studied, which is the woolly mammoth and the giant deer or megaloceros. And not only did many species go extinct, but even those which survived, such as reindeer, bison, wild horses, saw their distributions and numbers enormously squeezed in the Holocene. And those really are part of the same phenomenon. Some species were unfortunate enough to disappear completely, they went extinct. Others managed to hang on in reduced numbers. And we have quite a large project which is funded by the British Research Council to explore the pattern of timing and causes of the extinction of the megafauna by means of a program of radiocarbon dating of the mammals in comparison with new reconstructions of both vegetational change and the spread of modern humans, which are, of course, the two alternative main hypotheses for the cause of these extinctions. And as mentioned, these are the two taxa I'm going to concentrate on today. And the main method is the radiocarbon dating by the AMS method of bone samples of target species from across their geographical range through the time depth leading up to their extinction to try to understand in detail the patterns of change through time. To give one example of hundreds, this was a mammoth skeleton which we excavated in the west of England about 20 years ago. And what was important about this specimen was that when it was dated, it turned out to be only 12,000 radiocarbon years old, just about the very latest known from Europe at that time. It's since been confirmed by some records from other localities. And that's what we're looking for. What is the latest occurrence, not just globally, but in each region? And can we map that against the way that the vegetation was changing and the people were spreading? Go from that one point to this rather complex graph. I've lost my pointer again. There we are. Where we have on the vertical axis radiocarbon years from about 36,000 up to zero. And each blue point is one radiocarbon dated mammoth bone. So that skeleton that I just showed you would have formed one point on this graph. And we've split the very large number of mammoth radiocarbon dates, about 750 in all, into geographical regions, very broadly organized from west to east: Iberia, Italy, Ireland, Britain, Western Europe, Central Europe, Ukraine, on into Russia, and then Scandinavia, just for ease of presentation. The first thing we notice is that in the interval approximately between 18 and 16,000 radiocarbon years ago, we have the disappearance of the woolly mammoth from almost everywhere in Europe. This corresponds to the maximum of the LGM, the last glacial maximum, where the vegetational productivity presumably was not sufficient to support these animals. And we do, however, very interestingly pick up one area which we call Central Russian Plain West. It is broadly the area of around Moscow and Western European Russia, here it is, where the species persisted. So translate that into a map in your mind, and we have the squeezing of the broad range of the animals before the last glacial maximum into effectively a refugium. After the LGM, from about 16,000 years ago, however, the species spread out again. So we have it again across the broad range, and then at almost exactly 12,000 radiocarbon years ago, it is as though somebody has cut the graph with a knife. In all regions, we have the disappearance suddenly of this species at 12,000 years ago, with the exception here, which is in the far northeast of Europe, which I will come to later. And then we go to the vegetation maps. Now, our colleagues are in the process of constructing new and much improved time-sliced vegetation maps. These are rather old maps, but it broadly gives you the idea, because at 13,000 radiocarbon years ago, large areas of Europe are still covered by the steppic grassland vegetation that supported the mammoths. And by 12,000 years ago, because we have had the warming of the Berling-Alarod interstadial, woodlands, shown in green, have spread and covered most of Europe. And that is a remarkable coincidence to the regional extinction of the woolly mammoth, which is essentially a grass-eating mammal at exactly that time. And it does not correspond to the time at which modern humans spread into Europe after the LGM. That happened several thousand years earlier. So we seem to have a good effect, not directly of climate, because mammals are homeothermic. They're actually quite good at surviving different climatic regimes. It is the effect of the climate on the vegetation and then of the vegetation on the mammals. If, however, we then extend exactly the same graph further east, and these are samples all across Siberia, going again broadly from west to east, we do have an effect at 12,000 years. In quite a number of regions, there is this regional loss of the species at 12,000. But there are several places, such as the Yamal and Taimyr Peninsulae, and especially notably Wrangel Island, where the mammoth persists, we think, in local populations for a longer period. And that's the same graph. And if we now put that on a map of the latest populations where we have mammoths after 11,000 years ago, Although it's very difficult to reconstruct fragmentation from the fossil record, our interpretation of this is that as the steppe tundra habitat shrunk, it not only shrunk as the forests invaded from the south and the tundra invaded from the north, it fragmented. And in the last remaining patches of the steppic vegetation, so the last remaining patches of the woolly mammoth and other steppe tundra species persisted. So I'm now going to put all of that in a slightly different form, which is a kind of movie-style map. And each of these now is a radiocarbon-dated mammoth record, starting from before the LGM, where we have a very broad distribution of the species, still fine, up to about 24,000. As we start to cool into the last glacial maximum, thinning of records, we're now in the last glacial maximum, or the beginning of it, the records have thinned out. The maximum of the LGM is where the species has disappeared from Europe altogether, as shown in previous graph. And then after the LGM, but still in the glaciation where the steppe tundra is present again, and presumably with increased productivity after the LGM, re-expansion. Up to 12,000 years ago, when the forests begin to spread, and then suddenly, that's all that's left. And that's what I showed in the previous graph. It corresponds to the vegetational signal. Then we have the Younger Dryas, which is the brief recooling and presumably degeneration of the vegetation back to more open conditions again, and a somewhat of a re-spread. And then finally, in the early Holocene, and the famous Holocene records of mammoths, Wrangel Island, you probably know about. You may not know that on an island, which is an American island, but also in the Bering Sea in the last year, again, we have mid-Holocene mammoths discovered. What this whole story shows us is that extinction is not just a sudden event that happens everywhere at the same time. It has taken tens of thousands of years of complex distributional changes back and forth with these complex climatic changes before the species finally disappeared. As for the very last population on Wrangel Island, it vanished at about 3,700 BP. We do not have any particular climatic or vegetational signal at that time. What we do have is the entry of the first humans into that group of islands at a very close radiocarbon date. So although it is our belief that the changes in climate driving changes in vegetation are responsible for 95 or 99% of the enormous range contraction of this species, it still remains possible that humans, which were spreading widely in range and numbers at that time, could have finished off the final populations. But this is by no means the so-called overkill model, where humans are essentially thought to be responsible for the whole thing. We think that the climate and vegetation changes correlate very well with these major reductions in range, which have brought the species to the brink of extinction, and I'll come back to that in a while. I'm now going to talk about the giant deer, and we've partly chosen this one because it had a different ecology from the mammoth. It was a more temperate adapted species, which you can see purely from its geographical range. It is more to the south, and we interpret it as a mixed feeder, probably woodland edge, partly open ground, mixed grasses and woodland vegetation feeder. So it's interesting to see how a species with a different ecology responded to the same environmental cues. So this is basically the same sort of map. We don't have as many radiocarbon dates for this species, but here it is with a pretty broad range across Europe and Western Siberia before the last glacial maximum, and a much longer gap. Whereas the mammoth was only absent from Europe between 18 and 16,000, the peak of the cold, this species, which presumably is more sensitive, is absent for a much longer period during the LGM, and we are currently working on trying to find out where its refugium was, because it clearly was still around, because it returned again here in the late glacial. And if we look at a close-up of the later part of the previous graph. Here we are in the Lake Glacial, and here's the last glacial maximum gap. And as the climate warmed, as the climate warmed and the woodlands spread into Europe in the Berling, in the Berling Allerud, in the Berling Allerud Interstadial, so the species spread from wherever its refugium was, south or east, into Europe again. And notice that this is different from the mammoth, because I've marked there where the point at which in the previous graphs the mammoths disappeared. And when the mammoth went, when the grassland disappeared and the woodlands came in, the giant deer came back and spread wider when the woodlands came in, because that was its environment. And then also converse to the mammoth, we've got the actual extinction of the giant deer in Europe at the sudden cooling again, which was the Younger Dryas at about 10,500 radiocarbon years ago. The computer obviously wants you to see this graph, so we'll stick with it now. And here we've actually compressed the entire record across the whole geographical range of the two taxa, at least in Europe, so you can see the differences. First of all, that the LGM disappearance of the mammoth was much shorter, whereas the giant deer perceived it as a much longer event of unfavourable conditions. Then the giant deer came back, but because of the return of woodland in the Lake Glacial Interstadial, but that's when the mammoth cleared off. The giant deer died out in the Younger Dryas when the mammoth had a brief return before the start of the Holocene. So they are inverse because they are responding alternately to the cold-warm signal. What we discovered a few years ago, much to our surprise, was that the giant deer, however, although it had gone extinct across the whole of Europe in the Younger Dryas, which everybody thought was the end of the story, had actually survived in a refugium in the foothills of the Ural Mountains until only about 7,000 years ago. And we've been working with Russian colleagues who are doing pollen work in that part of the world. And they say that there was, at about 7,000 years ago, a regional intense drying episode, which they noticed as a clearing of forest and return to short grassland about that time, which might have been the cause of the final extinction of the giant deer in its last refuge in the Ural Mountains. So here's Megaloceros, the movie. Here we are before the last glacial maximum with a wide... Ignore the different colours, that's just different means of dating. Wide range. LGM, we think the refugium is in this area north of the Black Sea, but that is, these are not very well dated records. We're working on that. And then, for reasons that we don't entirely understand, the spread back again during the Allerud phase has a very restricted geographical signal, only in the extreme northwest of Europe, as far as we can tell. And then with the Younger Dryas, it disappears from Europe completely, and we have those final records in the Ural Mountains until about 7,000 years ago. What I want to draw now is a similarity. Although I've pointed out the differences between these two species, they are similar in this respect, in that they both had a complex succession of range expansions and contractions, finally leading up, in each case, to where I've drawn the thin red line, to an extinction across almost the whole of the range, but a final persistence in a last refugium, in the case of the mammoth in Wrangel Island, that's the records here, in the case of the giant deer in the mid-Ural region. And in each case, they had been squeezed into this small refugium. There may have been other refugia that we haven't discovered yet, but they were clearly isolated and rare, up into the middle of the Holocene. And then something, whether it was climate change, whether it was humans, wiped them out. And why I put that question mark, extinction lag, this is a phrase which people are using now in relation to the modern extinction crisis, that some conservation biologists are saying that while the number of species that have actually gone extinct in the modern crisis is at the moment relatively small, they think that many species are already at the point that although they are still with us, they are virtually committed to extinction. In other words, there is a time lag between the environmental effect and the final extinction. And I'm suggesting that these species here, the mammoth and the giant deer, once they had got squeezed into that very small population, these are large mammals, they need a large population size, wide range. Their genetic variation, which we're also studying with ancient DNA, I don't have time to go into that in detail, was also inevitably squeezed, so they were reduced in their adaptive potential. They were virtually committed to extinction, whatever the immediate cause of the event.
Have I more or less
finished? I think I will probably skip this bit and merely end up with this, because if you take a species like the Asian elephant today and look at its distribution map, it has become extremely reduced and fragmented into small populations. It is almost a mirror image of the latest Pleistocene map of the mammoth. And so I think there is a lesson to be drawn. A previous colleague pointed to the way in which the present can inform the past, and the past can also inform the present, that if populations are allowed to dwindle to small relict numbers of individuals in local areas, they may be doomed to extinction.
Vous venez d'entendre à l'instant Adrienne Lister, précédée par Laurent Labéry et Joël Guillot. Cette deuxième retransmission d'une série de cinq était consacrée à l'impact des événements climatiques sur notre environnement. Cet enregistrement a été réalisé lors du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes qui s'est déroulé en juillet 2007 à la Fondation Simone et Cino Del Duca, fondation de l'Institut de France. Poursuivez l'écoute des autres thématiques de ce colloque en téléchargeant les quatre autres émissions retransmettant la suite des communications dans notre médiathèque. Elles sont consacrées au rapport entre événements climatiques extrêmes et évolution des espèces, ainsi que les réponses des systèmes écologiques. Et puis les deux dernières retransmissions sont consacrées au bilan actuel des connaissances et aux recommandations pour se préparer aux prochaines crues, ouragans ou encore sécheresses. Merci de nous avoir suivis et à bientôt pour de nouvelles émissions.